The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and I am joined once again. With Ed Mattingly.
I can talk. I can talk, Nathan. You might have to go back to talking school.
I just thought I'd pass something down my esophagus that apparently hadn't quite made it. Many of you may remember Ed from the, 20 years ago, Ed? God, it seems
you
like
were my first
forever.
Guest on my radio broadcast back in 2000.
Was it really?
25
Jeez,
years ago.
That's scary and, I guess, gratifying all the same since I'm still around. But before we get started, I want to mention a few disclaimers. None of the hosts are rendering legal, accounting, or other professional advice. If you need such advice, you're advised to independently engage said professional advisors. Also, we're going to be talking about, about real estate private partnership syndications. And I want to just define those. And, Ed, you can jump in at any point if you need to tilt the deck towards today's topic. But typically the type of syndications that I work with in the tax realm involve a group of investors passively pooling their funds in a partnership under the United States SEC, or Security Exchange Commission's, crowdfunding statute. A syndicator, sponsor, or lead partner serves as the manager who's responsible for choosing a property, performing due diligence, and arranging its acquisition, including undertaking the necessary debt placement and equity raise. The manager's role is also tasked with managing the ongoing operations of the partnership and its assets throughout its existence. We do not sell investments, nor do we recommend or promote specific investment syndicators, sponsors, or lead partners. Rather, we assist your understanding of, quote, what you're signing up for, end quote, regarding opportunities that you may be considering. We'll show you how to evaluate sponsors, opportunities, and private placement offerings so you can select projects which may achieve the highest odds of a favorable outcome. And by the way, excuse me, I keep forgetting to say at the top of the show, I'm remembering today, that this show airs on both KSEV AM 700 and KGBC AM 1540. So we hope you can tune in on either one of those stations, whichever one gets you a better signal. I think, Ed, do you know right offhand, I think the AM 1540 is down south, maybe, Galveston, Friendswood, that
I'm not sure. I think it extends the opportunity for more listeners to actually hear KSEV AM 700 broadcast. It extends the geographic area.
Yes, certainly.
Let me add one thing about syndication, if you don't mind.
You bet.
For our listeners, it's important to understand that a private placement memorandum is something that is exempt from registration with the Securities and Exchange Administration. The SEC has set up some very formal rules on how these private placement memorandums can be handled. What's significant from the standpoint of an investor is that it's not publicly traded stock, hence the word private. You go to the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, the indexes, to buy publicly traded stocks. But a private placement memorandum is something where the individual investor needs to spend time and effort to become knowledgeable about the investment opportunity and make an independent decision from a business, legal, and tax standpoint. And that's why advisors are so beneficial to investors in that context.
Well, I agree with all that. And I guess one other thing we should add, which really is, I think, a problem, and I've watched this now in a couple other spaces. I remember, and Ed, you know what a 1031 intermediary is, yep. I presume. It's the party that facilitates a tax-free exchange between an unrelated buyer and seller, meaning that, you know, I don't have to do a 1031 exchange with someone that's necessarily taking my property and I'm buying theirs. You know, the intermediary creates the, I don't want to call it the market, but they create the opportunity for me to sell a property into a 1031 exchange to a buyer, say buyer A or investor A, and then I might purchase the back half of my transaction from investor G. And so anyway, it involves, however, the intermediary holding on to large amounts of money in many cases because you can't take it as the seller or you blow the tax-free status. And I tell you what, there were some real doozies of fraud along the way. And it wasn't, I'm going to say it was only sometime within the last maybe 15 years or so that that area became more regulated. Yeah. And Ed, go ahead.
If I can add something, since we use the term 1031, a lot of our listeners may not realize that what's happening is you're deferring or putting off into the future the actual payment of a tax. And I remember when I was in law school, my wills and estates professor, Stanley Johansson, the first day of class, said, "Class, keep this in mind. A tax dollar not paid today is a tax dollar not paid today." And I thought, that's kind of a stupid statement. But then I came to realize over experience over many decades what he was really trying to get at. And one of these tax-free exchanges is a way of saying, hey, I'm getting ready to sell an asset. I'm going to have to pay a capital gains tax on it if I do complete cash out where I've got, say, a piece of real estate or an operating business and I sell it for cash. Well, I'm going to have to go pay 20-25%, whatever the capital gains tax rate at that time is. But when you do an exchange, you're exchanging one asset for another asset, and maybe the asset you had wasn't producing income, but the asset that you're going to exchange for does produce income. A classic example is somebody owns raw real estate and gets ready to sell it, and instead of just taking cash, they swap out for pieces of land that already have a structure on it, already have a major tenant in it, already are paying income, and then you transfer the asset you got into something that's income producing, and you don't have to pay a capital gains tax at that time. It might be 20 years later when you sell that second asset that you pay capital gains tax. Hence, you've complied with the recommendation, a tax dollar not paid today is a tax dollar not paid today, which means you're leveraging the future with the IRS's money, legally.
True. And where I was headed with the lack of regulation was back to this wonderful area of real estate private partnership syndications, which are exempt from most of the reporting that would take, well, from almost all the reporting that would take place if it were traded, whether on the big boards or, you know, I guess the even down to the penny stock level, that stuff, I believe, is covered under the registration requirement. But, you know, what's interesting in my mind is that with the great popularity now of these real estate private partnerships, I mean, private equity has jumped in big time, and they're well known, these types of partnerships, in terms of the size of the transactions. And I know we've had transactions that involved, I can recall one that was close to $500 million. It was a portfolio transaction. And so there's a lot of money involved, and it's in situations like these that nefarious activities can occur. And I'm aware of a transaction right now that's come off the rails. It's not public what's getting ready to happen, so I'm not going to name names, but let's just say money laundering charges and plea bargains are currently in the pot being stirred. And it's just amazing to me that the amount of money that, you know, you put it in up front, and there's just nobody watching the leaders, the managers, the syndicators in these transactions.
If I can add something to what you're saying, a lot
sure.
of investors are foreign investors, and these foreign investors come from a different cultural and moral viewpoint of the world.
True.
And a lot of them take the attitude that the law is something to be either ignored or avoided as opposed to being followed. And it presents a real problem when you come into a culture like America, which really still is based upon the rule of law. I know major media outlets kind of poo-poo that, but the cold, hard reality is that people tend to follow the law here. Well, now it's kind of like you're mixing oil and water. And if somebody's got a whole bunch of money and they say, I want to invest in real estate deals, and I want you to be the local guy taking care of it, you get under a lot of pressure to cut corners and shave edges by doing that. And one of the things about Nathan Ross that our listening public can be aware of is he can stand up to him.
Well, I tell you, I have, you know, grave concerns that we're just a couple of steps away from being heavily regulated, because there's some bad stuff that's happened in the recent past. There's more bad stuff coming, and I think it may be more than, you know, some congressmen and senators will be able to withstand the barrage of constituents pain. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. But I remember 30 years ago, again, go back to, you know, the 1031 intermediaries, huge amounts of money sitting, you know, with an intermediary for an extended period. You know, 180 days, I think, is the longest that those can play out. A lot can go wrong in 180 days when it comes to somebody having access to your money. So, anyway. So, Ed, the title of today's topic that you wanted to address, I don't have my text up. Why don't you read again what you were
Pitfalls of commercial litigation, and this ties into what you do, Nathan, and that is, if you're an investor and you want to get involved in real estate, which is a great vehicle for creating wealth over time, then you want somebody like Nathan Ross and his team to manage that property, manage that asset, both the acquisition, the financing of it, the management of it, the selling of it, from both a day-to-day standpoint and from a tax standpoint. and of course, from a business opportunity standpoint. And one of the things that's done is to deal with litigation, because not all deals work out the way that you intend for them to do. And if you're an investor, you don't want to get sucked into litigation on an individual basis. Rather, you want somebody to handle it and manage it. And, you know, I can tell horror stories about how getting sucked into litigation not only dissipates wealth, but you lose the opportunity to create wealth. The best example I can give you is Pennzoil. Remember the Texaco versus Pennzoil case?
I do.
You know, Pennzoil signed a deal to acquire Getty Oil, and then Getty Oil decided to sell itself to Texaco. So Texaco bought Getty Oil, and Pennzoil was upset and sued Texaco / Getty Oil to get the profit that would have been made off of the acquisition of Getty Oil. It's a long story. I was blessed to be close friends with the assistant general counsel of Pennzoil, and when everything was all over and done with, I got a chance to find out what really went on. The interesting thing that I learned is Pennzoil was in that litigation for 4 years between the lawsuit and the bankruptcy that Texaco filed, and the management of Pennzoil was so focused on the litigation that they did not take advantage of the opportunities in the marketplace in the oil development business, and they would have made more money if they had just forgotten the Getty Oil deal and worked on their own and developing new business. They would have made more money than the $2.4 billion they got paid by Texaco in settlement.
And that's, you know, it's a lot of money, but looking back, it doesn't look like all that much.
Well, we're talking about 40
numbers.
We're talking about 40 years ago. But the interesting point is whether it's $100 deal, $1 million deal, or a $10 billion deal. Where is your focus?
Yeah.
In litigation, inherently, takes your focus away. The best way I express it to my clients is I say, every morning of your life when you get up, you have to make a fundamental decision. Do you go to the front of the train and look at the future coming towards you, or do you go to the back of the train, stand in the caboose, and look at the past going away from you? And most people will choose to go to the front of the train and look at the future coming at them, because that's really where you want to be as a human being.
Yeah.
Litigation is inherently standing at the back of the caboose, looking at the past, moving away from you.
Yeah. Now, I've always had the mindset that, hey, let's go make more money instead of worrying about the spilt milk, because I've watched it. I mean, not from your vantage point. I mean, we worked in quite a few bankruptcy cases. In fact, the largest bankruptcy cases pre-Enron, and I saw significant amount of money that are passed out to everybody but the creditors throughout that process, okay? And it's sickening. And yet, I don't know of a better way. I mean, somebody's got to retrieve assets. They got to spend litigation dollars and other administrative dollars to get there. But I tell you what, it was that whole arena in my mind, and I'm glad I'm not working in that area anymore, but it was
Nathan,
like
let me interrupt just for a second, because I read something this morning. It's along the lines of bankruptcy. For 30 years, I was regional counsel for Sears Roebuck and Company, going back to 1984. And at the time that I became regional counsel, Sears was the largest retailer in the world. Sears owned Discover Card. It owned Dean Witter, which is a brokerage firm. It owned Allstate Insurance Company. It owned Coldwell Banker, the largest real estate agency in America.
Man, blue chip brand.
I mean, blue chip. It was, you know, of course, it was one of the 30 leading indicators on the New York Stock Exchange, et cetera. And I like to tell everybody, I drove them into bankruptcy. Back in the 80s, Sears had the catalog. And our older listeners remember the Sears catalog. It was the Bible of retail. Everybody looked forward to getting the catalog and seeing what was available for sale. And Sears continued to offer the catalog until the 90s. And it was about the mid-90s when they dropped it, which is about the same time when Amazon went on the Internet and started selling things. The same thing. They posted the Sears catalog, literally or figuratively, on the Internet, but were able to change it daily. The problem with the Sears catalog, it was fixed. The price was fixed for a weed eater for a year, and all the competitors undercut Sears. And Sears didn't respond. If Sears had just held on to the catalog and digitized it to put it on the Internet, it would be monstrously huge today because it had the brand name. I mean, instead of Amazon, you'd be buying from Sears. Instead of Walmart, you'd be buying from Sears. So it's just amazing how they failed to see the future. And that's what people need to understand in investment. You're looking to the future, and you need good advice and counsel as to what is a realistic view of the future. Where are the potential opportunities, and how can you best exploit it? And secondarily, how can you minimize the taxes that are going to flow when you are successful?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, and again, it's been just over 20 years since I started focusing on, and by the way, just to clean something up, I've never syndicated myself. I've only advised, and then I've drafted, I don't know, $500 million worth of complex sharing arrangement operating agreements over that time frame. But I'm going to tell you, in my mind, investing in these syndications really boils down. I mean, assuming everybody can put a pro forma together, everybody, I mean, at some point, the people that are in this game full time, they know how to do the analysis. There's no magic bullet. I mean, there are a few little tweaks here and there, I won't say, but I don't really look at those as something that gives you a leg up. But you know what does give you a leg up?
Tell me.
Credibility.
Yes.
Credibility and trust. And this syndication, the underlying, the thing that everybody has to do at some point is either hold your nose and move forward or just stop. Because you're never going to be able to see exactly what's going to happen. If you could, it costs you a lot more to get in to that deal. And yet, the ones that go bad, invariably, it's either a calamity like, you know, a flood took out one of my clients' buildings in Galveston. And that involved commercial litigation. You've never seen this happen, Ed, but the partnership had to sue the insurance company for not covering whatever was supposed to have been covered in their mind, took it to the Texas Supreme Court before they finally gave up. But bottom line is it's not the things that we fear most often. It's the unknowns involving character and morals and, you know, lack of control, things of that nature.
Let me share a story of good character and how it makes a difference. Uh-huh. My former father-in-law was a wealthy real estate developer and very well respected. And one of the persons that invested in his developments was Dr. Michael DeBakey, a man who's had his fingers in 10,000 hearts. The preeminent heart surgeon in the world. And when my former father-in-law, after his wife died, and it was like 7 years later, he was marrying another woman, a woman his own age, I might add, Dr. DeBakey was a guest. And I went up and introduced myself to Dr. DeBakey, because he was like 92 at the time. And I wanted to shake the hand that had been inside of 10,000 hearts. And so we were sitting there chit-chatting, and he asked me who I was, and I explained, you know, I was a former son-in-law. And then I said, well, you know, how do you know my former father-in-law? And he said, well, Ed, I met him one day, and I knew that he did real estate deals, and he asked me to join one of his deals, and it was going to cost me $400,000. And I had my lawyer and my accountant, financial consultant and my real estate broker and my CPA and everybody else checked it out. And they all said it was a good deal. And so hesitantly, I signed off and invested the money. And 3 years later, I got a check for $2 million. He said anytime Harvey called him after that to talk about a deal, he never asked what the deal was. He said, "How much do you want?" And he told me he made more money off of my former father-in-law than he did practicing medicine.
Well, that could have been. That could have been.
You know, and so I cite that as an example to all of us. Because my former father-in-law said, give a man a benefit of the doubt first time you meet him. But if he ever lies or does something fraudulent, have nothing to do with him ever again.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
That's good.
And
good
he
advice.
Said, you're going to lose some money that way because, you know, sometimes you get flim-flammed by somebody. But he said, the real art is avoiding a known bad guy.
Well, I agree. And that kind of reminds me of something that I've watched over the years as well. You know, you get into agreements and operating agreements and contracts. And what I've come to realize is contracts are not going to prevent you from getting misled or otherwise scammed or conned. They're to remind us honest people what we agreed to way back when. Because, you know, I've entered into many transactions over the years where things get fuzzy, and it's good to go back to something that we both executed to remind, okay, that's what we agreed to do, and that's how we proceed. But con artists will have a way to get around anything they've ever executed, and it doesn't prevent any of that. And it's like you've already pointed out, you're better off trying to make more money plowing new fertile pastures than going back and trying to start over.
Yeah, but, I mean, we lawyers draft these long, lengthy contracts, and businessmen get upset with us for drafting it, you know, especially small and medium-sized business owners, because he said, well, we went to the restaurant, we got out a paper napkin, we got out a pen, and we stretched out the deal. Oh, that's good enough for me. I'm going to honor my word. That's what businessmen will tell you.
Yeah,
and my response to that is very simple. I say, well, wait a second. Yeah, you know what the deal is, and you're going to honor it with the other guy. But we lawyers draft contracts for people not in the room at the time you make the deal. And they have very specific titles. They're called IRS agents. They're called landlords. They're called judges and jurors. They're called CPAs. They're called divorce attorneys. They're called probate judges. We're drafting documents to tie the hands of people not in the room. Your job is to figure out whether or not the deal is good and whether or not the guy you're dealing with is honest. My job as a lawyer is to tie the hands of people not in the room. But if you do a deal with a dishonest guy, he's going to beat the contract. He's going to figure out a way to beat the contract or somehow take advantage of it.
Yeah,
because that's the way they make their money.
Ed, when you get into the guts of commercial real estate litigation, where would you circle the majority of the types of actions that you see if you were trying to put a circle around
construction defects?
Debt,
construction defects.
Construction defects. Okay, and see, we don't run into much of that, if any, when you're buying 40 to 60-year-old Class C apartments, Class C minus, that's, you know, kind of an area that doesn't rise to the top. I mean, we'll see things with lenders. We'll see things. Well, I'll tell you one we see is sellers misrepresenting what you're buying.
Yep.
You know, it's amazing how often that happens. But on construction defects, I mean, I've been tangential to a couple of those. I had a buddy that was a construction superintendent down at the Post at Midtown development. You've probably seen that, or I don't know if it's called that anymore, but it was, you know, the Post group out of Atlanta, I believe, is who was the owner. But, you know, they had the, you remember the EFIS? I think I'm saying
that. That was the example I was going to use.
Oh, was it? Well, yeah. EFIS is like a stucco wannabe, right? Kind of a knockoff.
It's an artificial stucco exterior surface to either office buildings or residential homes.
Yeah, and I mean, so many of those. And they involved what, in many cases, were top developers. I know Randall Davis had a couple buildings there in River Oaks area that had issues.
Initially, nobody knew that there was an inherent defect in the EIFS style of installation. It wasn't so much that the product itself was bad, but the method of installation that was recommended was the problem. I handled several EIFS cases. And what happens is you got a good faith owner of the land who hires a good faith general contractor who gets together with a good faith architect, and they design a house or a building that's going to have an EIFS cladded exterior to the building, and then they hire a good foundation company and a good structural company and a good roofing company and a good plumber and electrician and everything else and exterior cladding people. And what happens is, instead of that exterior cladding lasting 20 years, 4 years into the deal, it starts to fail. And it leaks. And now you got water coming into the house. And you got mold developing. Well, what happens is the whomever then owns the property sues the architect, sues the general contractor, sues the vendors of the EIFS, and sue all of the subcontractors involved. And even if they only just sue the general contractor, the general's going to sue all the subs and the vendors also. So you'll have 8, 9, 10 law firms involved representing different defendants. And then invariably, some of those defendants have liability insurance that includes products completed operations hazard, and some don't. So now you're going to have secondary lawsuits between insureds and insurance companies as to coverage.
Yeah.
And of course, love it because these cases result in making enough money to put your kid through college.
I was going to say, I'm sure most lawyers are going to let the defendants with insurance companies go ahead and leave the case, right? They would never try to take advantage of an insurance policy, right?
Everybody's looking to have an insurance company in the case because think about it, contractor, whether it's a general contractor or a subcontractor, owns no assets. Their only asset is each contract that they have. And those contracts, once completed, the money is pulled out of the business and put into the individual owner's personal bank accounts. So you have these situations that, unless you're dealing with really big entities as contractors and as subcontractors, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of empty pockets. And that's another, leads me to another story I learned in law school, and that is, what is the quest of all litigation in civil litigation? It's for a deep pocket.
They got to be someone that's not, or it's a great lawsuit. They can't be somebody that's got nothing to lose.
Yeah,
when you got nothing to lose, you know, a piece of paper didn't get an attorney much.
I tell you, I have several judgments that are beautifully framed and sitting on the wall and for big dollars that are worth no more than the frame is worth more than the judgment. anyway, that you know, the problem with commercial litigation is seeking the deep pocket, and you run into problems that maybe somebody was wealthy at the time that the event occurred, maybe even wealthy at the beginning of the lawsuit, but then they run into other problems unrelated to your matter, and they have to file for bankruptcy. And what's really bad is moving the entire case into bankruptcy court. Oh, it's just chaos. Well,
it's amazing. I know we worked on some real estate cases, and I mean, they were very complicated before the bankruptcy filing, and that, of course, layered on all the lawyers' fees, both sides of the bankruptcy process, and it's like I've said many times, there ought to be some way you can carve up whatever assets are there at the outset. The problem is who determines what an asset is and what the clawbacks are, and you know who has preference and all that stuff.
The way the system is set up now, the ability to pay is not an issue for a trial court prior to the entry of judgment. So sharp defense attorneys are successful at keeping at bay plaintiff's inquiries into the financial net worth of the defendant. Now, there are some artful ways that plaintiff attorneys can get around that, but that's one of the jobs that defense attorneys do is stall and delay. And, you know, it's frustrating when you're on the plaintiff side. Heck, it's frustrating when you're the client, either on the plaintiff or the defense side, because you see all these attorney's fees just rolling up.
Well, is the policy limit one of the things that's hard to get clarity on?
No. Once suit is filed, you'll know the policy limits within 30 days.
I gotcha.
Once the first defendant files an answer within 30 days. So you can find that out pretty quick. Now, collecting on it, getting the insurance company to pay it is another matter.
Yeah. Well, true. I don't need to go there. What would be another area besides construction defects, Ed, that you run into? What about disputes?
Fraud.
Between...
Fraud is the other big area. You got to understand, middle management people and sometimes large corporations are, generally speaking, led by alpha males. And when one alpha male feels that another alpha male has taken advantage of the first alpha male, then that's time for a bloodletting. And they want to use every tool available in the toolbox to go after the perceived bad guy. If they think they have been defrauded and they got the deep resources of a mid-size or a large-size company, they can go after them. And the problem with that is, like I cited with Pennzoil, you lose focus. You lose focus on what your business really is. Litigation is not your business. The more arrogant and snobbish and intellectual the alpha male is, the more I love it as a trial attorney on the opposition, because I can lead that guy right down the primrose path in terms of questions that I get to ask in a deposition or on the witness stand. And it's nothing illegal or immoral or distasteful that I do. It's just the cold, hard facts. And alpha males tend to see the world from their own perspective and not from the perspective of anyone else. And the cold, hard reality, the world is not black and white. The world is gray. It's different shades of gray. And once a juror perceives that somebody is not being honest with themselves and not being honest with the jury, it's death for that side in front of a jury.
Yeah. Let's see. You said something there I was going to follow up on. I've kind of going through a dispute right now with partners where I am a tenant, the building I'm in, which is getting ready to end real quick. But I've watched the two partners have a falling out a year or so ago, and nothing good has happened since that period. Everything you can look at, the physical condition of the building, the value of the building, it did just sell, thankfully. Not that it's going to matter to me, because my space is right where the new owner wants their showroom. So we're being offered an early out. But I tell you, I'd shake my head at times thinking about what that dispute cost those two partners by the time they got around to selling the building. Of course, it went through a bankruptcy too, so you got that significant layer of cost as well. But what about some stories where litigation turned out good, Ed? Do you have any of those, or is those non-existent? They weren't as bad. Maybe that's how I should have phrased that question.
Oh, I've got numerous stories about things going good. You know, it all depends on how you want to say what is good and what is bad from the standpoint.
Yeah, where are you right it or wrong? How about that?
Usually I've been on the defense side of the docket, you know, usually in personal injury right. litigation, much, much more commercial litigation nowadays, and, of course, probate litigation. A probate case that I handled once years ago was interesting from this alpha male standpoint. I represented a man who was worth about $1.25 million, died, was survived by four kids. The oldest kid was a convicted felon and was a con man. And then there was three other kids. I represented the other three. The con man had done wrong to the father when the con man was young. And so the father cut him out of the will. And that will had been around for 20 years. And then in the last year of the old man's life, he was dying of cancer. And the con man moved in with him and took great care of him. I mean, no complaints with the quality of the care. But during the 1 year that the con man lived with the father, there was four wills. The first new will said all for four each equally. And then and by the time you got to the fourth will, it said all for me and none for three. He died. We tried that case for 2 weeks, and it was one of the wildest cases I've ever tried. I mean, there were so many unbelievable things, and there was exorcisms. There was devil worship. There was all this stuff going on. And the jury was out for 45 minutes, and they came back and said they threw out all four of those wills and gave everything to my three clients and plus stacked attorney's fees onto it. So it was
which
it was
is the important part.
Yeah, right? it was interesting. But an important thing to note, Nathan, what I have come to realize is jurors no longer believe what a human being says, even under oath, from the witness stand. What they believe is what was written contemporaneous to the transaction in question. Now, what I mean by that is, if you and I are talking, and I say black, and then I follow up and I send a letter to you and said, Nathan, we talked today about X, and I said black, signed X. And then we get into a dispute and we're in front of the jury and you say white and I say black. The jury doesn't believe either one of us. But that email I sent to you that said black, that was the date that you and I talked, it goes to the jury. It's in the jury room when they deliberate. It's a living witness inside the jury room giving testimony. And they'll believe that email. And that's how they'll rule. Which means if you know that there's a hint of a possibility of litigation down the road, and you should assume every transaction you're involved with might wind up in litigation, document it. Paper trail it. In fact, I'll give you and everybody else a little hint on a way to make it even more credible. Let's say in that conversation when I said black and you said white in the phone conversation, let's say you mentioned that your son had hit a home run in his Little League baseball game the night before. So I start the letter off and say, Dear Nathan, happy to see that your son, Junior, hit a home run yesterday. You must be a proud father. Oh, by the way, I said black, you said white. Now, that becomes an exhibit in a dispute between you and me. And there are going to be 12 jurors. Six of them will be females. And when they read that, what do they think of me? He's a nice guy. He thought about Nathan's son.
I would say it sounds like what you're saying, Rev 1, of whatever the action is the one that's going to get the most, priority, the most weighting.
Yep.
Like in the four wills,
yep.
I'm assuming the original will was probably the one that ended up at the end of the day being
the original will said all for three and none for thee.
Yeah.
But he was such a liar. I mean, it was it's a great story. It's a two beer story to tell the story of that trial. You and I would sit there and drink two beers in length of time it'd take me to tell the story, and it's very entertaining. But anyway, enough on all that. Trial lawyers can tell stories all day long.
Yeah. What about in terms of commercial litigation? Are there any classes of real estate? Forget about apartments for the moment, that tend to draw litigants more readily than others? Office, industrial, healthcare facilities?
Smaller cases draw more litigation. Larger cases, invariably, one of the parties is a fairly large institution and has put an arbitration, mandatory binding arbitration provision in the contract. And all the courts order those cases immediately to go to arbitration because it clears the court's docket.
Yeah.
And arbitration is not cheaper than litigation. And in some counties, it's quicker. In a lot of counties, it's not quicker. And the problem with arbitration is that the ruling is arbitrary. And the final, and the final problem with arbitration that my big complaint is it's good when it's business to business. It's terrible when it's business to consumer. Because arbitrator is picked, he or she is working for the next case. And a consumer is only going to be in arbitration once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
But a large real estate developer or broker is going to be in arbitration weekly. So if you're the arbitrator and you're getting paid your time to participate in arbitration, you know if you rule against the big guy in favor of the little guy, you get blackballed on any future arbitration involving that big guy.
And Ed, confirm, well, maybe you should explain, arbitration versus mediation, they are not the same animal.
That is a correct statement.
And arbitration's binding, correct? Whereas mediation is maybe on its way to a trial.
98% of all arbitration is binding. It's only if the parties have agreed in advance in a contract written long before the dispute ever arises that it would be non-binding. It's almost never you do that. And always big entities that are dealing with a little person are always going to have a binding arbitration provision in their contract.
Yeah.
And so it's to their advantage, both in terms of winning and in terms of cost and in terms of deterring a dispute from being presented. So mediation is different. Mediation is when a dispute arises and the parties, either by agreement or per court order, choose to go to a neutral, a third-party neutral, who hears the evidence and the arguments on both sides and then tries to get the two sides to work towards a settlement. I like to say it this way. A mediator is a slave to settlement. He or she only wants the two parties to agree. The mediator doesn't care who wins or loses. That's winning to a mediator is a settlement. A bad settlement is a victory. A good settlement is a victory for the mediator.
Yeah.
A failure to settle is a loss for the mediator. Ergo, go ahead.
So if you're advising a client at the outset, do you walk away from a deal, especially if it's against a larger party? Do you walk away if you can't get a mediation provision instead of arbitration?
Most contracts nowadays are written where the parties are, one, supposed to negotiate informally. Two, if negotiation doesn't finalize a settlement, then non-binding mediation. And then if the mediation fails, the third step is binding arbitration.
Oh, so you may end up going through all the above.
Yeah, and what I do in the contracts I draft is I put a provision in there that if one side chooses not to participate in non-binding mediation, then and either arbitration or litigation is filed, then the recalcitrant party cannot recover interest, punitive damages, or attorney's fees. Whereas the participating party can recover damages, interest, court costs, punitive damages, and attorney's fees. Now, that language forces both sides to show up and talk.
Yeah, it sure does.
And that's what you want. You want them to talk.
Yeah, sure, sure.
You know, that's what Donald Trump's trying to do right now with the Ukrainians and the Russians. He's trying to get them to talk. Yeah. And he's threatening and he's cajoling them. He's bribing them. He's probably doing everything he possibly can short of, you know, shooting bullets. But that's what a meteor tries to do, to get people to talk. In two out of every three cases that go through mediation, settle either that day or within 2 weeks.
Huh. I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah, it's very high. It's a very effective tool. I'm a big believer in mediation.
And you think of the lower cost to adjudicate.
The mediator will make it very clear to both alpha males that the lawyer that they've hired is a very good lawyer and charges a very high fee, and that lawyer is going to put a kid through college on their backs unless they settle now.
Well, we've only got about a minute and a half left, Ed. What else? Maybe we think about some topics for the future. And by the way, feel free to text me at 713-782-1900 if you have some topics you'd like to hear discussed. And, it's easy for us to plan ahead more so than change in midstream when we're already talking about a given topic.
You know, I think another topic we might want to consider discussing in the future, Nathan, is insurance. Insurance for businesses and insurance for investors and what they can do. I'm not talking so much about life insurance, but liability insurance. And I'm a big believer in disability insurance as well.
Yeah, no, those are good points. Well, I appreciate those that tuned in today, and I want to encourage you again to send us questions, send us topics, and if you have something that you'd rather discuss on the phone, well, by all means, leave me a message, and I'll be happy to call you back, or if it's more appropriate, I'll have Ed give you a call.
So, may I give out my phone number, Nathan?
Oh, you sure can.
Ed Mattingly at the Mattingly Law Firm, 713-467-4400. That's 467-4400. I'm still practicing law after all these years.
That's a good number. I don't know how you ended up with
it. I've had it a long time.
Yeah. Well, then it's a good 713 number. It's a real Houston number, as I say.
Years ago, I had a car, and I got a license plate issued by the state of Texas, a random license plate. It wasn't a personalized one. NVY007.
Wow.
Navy James Bond.
Okay.
When I sold the car, I wanted to keep the license plate.
I hear the music, so we're going to sign off and look forward to Sunday at 7 a.m., at least one of us. Maybe someday we can get Ed to get up early on a Sunday and have him there as well. Okay, well, thank you for listening, and we look forward to the next time.
God bless everybody.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.